Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance. We're broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. Kintec Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in step 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. School's out. Summer's here. Kick it off with the BC Lions summer camp game Saturday, June 21st at 4 p.m. For details and tickets, visit bclions.com. Guests on Sportsnet 650, call in on the hotline. Powered by Power West Industries. Don't get caught in the dark when it matters most. Visit them at powerwest.ca today. They keep the lights on. Now joining us on the hotline, he is a reporter for the Abbotsford News. He's been all over the Abbey Canucks Calder Cup final run, which is now just one win away from a successful conclusion. He is Ben Lipka joining us now on Canucks Talk. Ben, thanks for doing this today. How are you?
Good. Thanks a lot for the invite, guys.
Yeah, it's our pleasure. And I mean, this is just a really cool story that's developed for Abbotsford, for the Canucks organization. And you know, I wasn't in the building last night. I know you were, but you see the pictures and the videos on social media of the energy in that building, you know, waving the towels, all of that, just how loud it is. What's it been like to be there? And especially for these last couple of games in the final, what's the atmosphere been like from your perspective?
Yeah, last night's game, that like it was a record-breaking crowd. That was the biggest crowd they've ever had for a Canucks game in the Abbey Center. So yeah, that crowd was completely insane, and they sold it. I heard 90 standing room tickets. So that's an area just above the Zamboni, where the Zamboni comes out. So that they were completely packed with people there. Someone else told me 150. So I'm not sure the actual number, but there was So it was jam packed. Every seat was filled. I even heard a rumor that there was Connor Bedard. Connor Bedard was in the building. That was a rumor some security guard told me. I don't know if that's true or not. I was trying to, like, I was zooming in on every suite, and I didn't see him. So, unfortunately, I can't confirm that. But a bunch of people told me that. But, yeah, just the crowd in general, they were wild. And the good thing about yesterday's game was, unlike a lot of games for Abbotsford during this whole playoff run, like, they've had good finishes. They haven't had great starts.
Right.
And they scored a minute into this game, and the crowd, like, it was a party from that point on. Like, they led the entire game, and there wasn't really, I know they came back to draw within one, but there wasn't really any real threat, I felt, especially after Bain scored that second goal, that Charlotte was coming back into the game. So, yeah, the fans were wild, for sure, last night. And they even, this is funny, I was talking to the Canucks DJ about this, but he played the in the past, he's played the Kurt Angle, you know, the Kurt Angle "You Suck"
sure song. Yes,
song. Yeah, so he's played that in the past, and fans had no reaction to that. Like, there was no reaction, but last night it worked, and I'm a huge wrestling fan, so that was kind of a big thrill for me to hear the Kurt Angle "You Suck" chant in Abbotsford and fans going along with it. So that was kind of an example, like, how lit up that crowd was last night.
I love that. It's just, they got to the Calder Cup final, and that's when the mid-2000s wrestling fans really turned out and showed up for it. By the way, I love the idea of, like, part of an urban legend from this Calder Cup run being that Connor Bedard was in the building, you know, scouting his future teammates.
He's like Abbotsford Taylor Swift. He's Abbotsford Taylor Swift.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. We got to get the shots of him in the suite there. And we were talking in the first segment, you know, obviously, naturally, we're going to focus on the on-ice side of this, right? And Manny Malhotra and Lekker Mäki and the young players and all that. But I also think at this stage, and we were just talking about how loud the building, how electric it was, what this could mean from an off-ice perspective for the Abbotsford Canucks and for their relationship with the city of Abbotsford. Just give us a sense of kind of what impact you think this could have and kind of how you've seen that relationship grow from since the Abbotsford Canucks arrived in town and now culminating with what they're doing in the Calder Cup Finals right now.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. Like, so I think the relationship, the city, everything I've heard, the city and the Canucks are both pretty satisfied with everything that's been going on. The only problem is, like, and I know I've been sitting on this story for a while just because they're still playing, but attendance during the regular season was down quite a bit this year as opposed to the past few years. Like, they were at 4,800 in 22-23 and about that same amount last year. And they dipped to 4,100 this year. I think it's a combination of maybe, you know, economic issues and also there were a lot of people that signed up for that initial 3-year season ticket plan and maybe just didn't enjoy their experience. That's what I've heard anyway. So as far as that goes, I think they can probably get some people back now with all this success. I don't see how they couldn't. And I know personally a lot of my friends are coming in from Vancouver and other places. They're checking out the Absurd Center for the first time. They're enjoying it. It's a fun place to watch a game. There's no really bad seats. So I think there's only positives that can come from all this success.
Ben, what did you make of Jonathan Lekaramäki's performance yesterday, especially relative to what we've seen throughout the playoffs?
Yeah, so I was one of the people, like, I was not shocked when he got scratched for the first two games of the final just because he just wasn't effective. He looked still kind of slow. Maybe he was still suffering from the oral surgery, whatever that was. He wasn't an effective player, and he's getting a ton of minutes, and I thought that was a good move by Manny to let him sit for a bit. And that's what a lot of people need to understand with rookies in the AHL. This is the first time they're playing this amount of games, and it's a long season. It's a lot of travel. So rookies don't often play the entire season. It's tough. Like that happened with Kirill Kudryavtsev for a few games earlier in the season. But it's good for the younger players to kind of sit up there and watch from above. But that being said, I wanted Lekaramäki back in for game three. They needed a shake up. And I mean, it's worked out well. And that's kind of an example of just some of the adjustments that Manny Malhotra's made throughout this entire season. And they all seem to be paying off. He's like a mad scientist in there. Like, everything seems to be working. Like, for example, like, I know you put Lekaramäki goes in, and I thought Klimovic was probably going to be scratched because Klimovic usually needs top 6 minutes to be effective. But he moved Klimovic to the fourth line, and personally, I was kind of, you know, I didn't really think it was going to work just because Klimovic, he needs those top line minutes to get motivated, and sometimes he doesn't really get engaged with bottom 6 minutes, but I thought he's been great in games 3 and 4 too. So that's kind of another example of Manny being able to read his players, make adjustments, and just seemingly make the right decisions all the time. Like, he's hit on almost everything this season. But yeah, with Lekaramäki, I honestly do think he just needed a little bit of a break, watch the game from above. And he has skill. It's just, I think he was a little too beat up, or the oral surgery effects were still hurting him, but he looked great. I thought he looked pretty good in game three also. Like, he was actually playing a little more physical and just getting open. But yeah, no, he was awesome last night. Really, he has to be really, really thrilled with that performance, and so did the Canucks.
Internally, there seems to be a lot of appreciation for this sort of group, whether it's some of the American League contract guys who've been there for a bit, like Chase Waters, but also guys like also some of the other guys who've sort of been down there for a bit, the Baines, Sasson tier of guys, and sort of this decision that the organization feels like this core group made to not be satisfied at any point, right? That, you know, to go through the Calder Cup playoffs, you need to make a decision as a group that, yeah, we've won two rounds. That's still not good enough. Mm-hmm. We still want to do this. We want to accomplish this thing together. What's the sense that you've had about that being around this club over the course of this season?
Yeah, it was just funny. Like, even last night, you'd think they'd be a little happier, but like, Manny seemed no different than even the regular season or round one of the playoffs. Like, he wasn't really noticeably different. I missed Chase Waters media, but he sounded very similar to how he sounded earlier in the season. There's not a lot of emotion with this team, it seems like, especially like post game anyway. They're a machine. And I think it starts with Manny. He's a super calm guy, and I think he kind of keeps everybody extremely even keeled. And it's unfortunately for the media, it's not that exciting. But he never gets too high or too low. And like even when they won the coveted Robert W. Clark Trophy for the Western Conference Championship, like it was kind of like nobody was excited. They didn't touch it. Like I mean, they were happy on the ice, but. You could tell they weren't satisfied. So yeah, no, I think that's the mindset of Manny. Yeah, totally.
And you know, it's interesting that you bring up kind of that never too high, never too low thing. And I know, I think it was Jeff Patterson yesterday on social media after the win saying like, go back to the regular season really. And when that 13 game winning streak started. And since then their record is pretty much unbelievable. Like there was no drop off. Everyone knew the winning streak was going to end at some point, but it's not as if that was this aberration. And then they dropped kind of back to earth and went back to their previous record. Like looking back now, that really looks like the start of a higher level for this team that they've been able to sustain all the way to being a win away from winning the Calder Cup. What was it? Like, was it just the accumulation of, you know, the message Malhotra was preaching and his work with the team? Was there some impetus or something that changed or happened that allowed them to kind of hit that new level?
Yeah, I it's hard when you're not in the room, but I think there was a stretch in late December, early January where they lost six in a row. They lost, I believe they lost two to Calgary. They lost two at home to Tucson. Then they lost two to, I think, Laval. And it was... Yeah, and they were out of the playoffs at that point, and since then they've completely turned around. But I do think, yeah, it's just Manny's message finally getting through. That's what my guess would be, and because honestly, the players around that time, Vancouver was calling everybody up, as you guys probably remember.
Right.
Like Abbotsford was getting every day, guys were getting moved up and down. So there wasn't really a solid roster, and the best Abbotsford players were up in Vancouver. Like Sasson was up for a while. Baines was up. The one constant has been Manny. And I think that's kind of been the difference maker, just the attitude he's brought to the team.
So at the risk of jinxing things here, I've heard other people on the air talk about it, so I'm not the first one to bring it up. If they get it done, if they take home the Calder Cup, is there a parade in Abbotsford? Where is the parade in Abbotsford if it happens?
I've been talking about, I've been trying to think about that. So we do have the Canada Day Parade, which
is
July 1st, and that's a big one. It goes down South Fraser Way, goes down Trithewey Street to Rotary Stadium. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that, but that's a big stadium that does rugby, high school rugby and football and stuff like that. So I'm pretty sure they've regularly been a part of that parade every year. So, I mean, they could have a little thing with on the Abbotsford Canucks float with the cop, obviously. But I know I'm getting ahead of myself, but if they win, I think they should probably have their own thing. Don't you guys think? I think there's enough fans that would want to come out to.
I feel like just watching the scenes and seeing the reaction out there. And I mean, look, if you're going to win a major, this is significant, man. This is the second biggest league, second best league in North America. You're going to win a title. Like, treat yourself to a parade, I think.
Yeah. And I was thinking, for them, if you want something different than Canada Day, you want to go down maybe King Road, which is the arena that's right in front of Abbotsford Center. It goes quite a ways. So you could have a parade there, and then you could have a rally in the parking lot or something. But I don't want to jinx anything, but if I was the Canucks and I win, then that's probably what I would do, something like that. Because I do think they deserve their own parade and their own celebration. This is the first time, and I was looking this up, and I've talked to a few people, so I'm pretty sure this is accurate, but a pro hockey team from BC hasn't won a major championship since 1925. It's been 100 years. The Victoria Cougars in 1925 beat Montreal 3-1, right, for the Stanley Cup. So and Vancouver Canucks, obviously, they've never won anything, 50-plus years. No other team from BC's even been in the Calder Cup finals. No team from BC has been in the ECHL finals. So, I mean, it's been 100 years. I think they should get their own parade if they win.
Ben, this was awesome, man. I really enjoyed this, and I love the Connor Bedard tidbit rumor. And you're not reporting it. You're just putting it out there that you heard it, but that's fantastic stuff. Yeah. Thanks for doing this, man. We appreciate it.
Anytime, guys. Thanks.
That is Ben Lipka, reporter for the Abbotsford News, joining us and weighing in on some of the hockey stuff. And again, some of the off-ice stuff going on with the Abbotsford Canucks and what this could mean. And interesting to hear the report that, attendance was down a little bit, right? And I do wonder, in the regular season, at least, you know, he mentioned like economic situation, things like that. Maybe some people not satisfied with the experience. I wonder how much the Vancouver Canucks majorly struggling and kind of turning people off at the NHL level affected attendance at the AHL level in Abbotsford as well. But certainly you hope that a run like this can erase some of that and, you know, get that attendance number back up going into next season for Abby. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. You can send your thoughts in. I did just want to pass this along as well from Patrick Johnston in the province and Post Media. And we've been doing a lot of quoting and relaying PJ articles recently. So he's doing a fantastic job on the beat. But the latest from PJ, kind of picking up on a story which we've been monitoring on the show, he says, according to multiple sources, the owners of the Vancouver Canucks, Francesco and Roberto Aquilini, and their father, Luigi Aquilini, are still looking for a minority investor who can bring about $500 million to the table, which would presumably help buy out brother Paolo's stake in the team. So this is kind of the information that helps make sense of a lot of the other ownership stuff that we've been hearing, right? Going all the way back to the Nick Kyprios report, the team statement, the Paolo's stepping away from the organization, rumors about is it for sale? No, it's not for sale, but potentially at least a stake of it, a minority stake of it, according to PJ sources, could be, if not for sale, they're at least exploring the possibility.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, it would explain why there's so many rumors, right? And
there's
so many names that don't otherwise make sense being bandied about locally by people, you know, more or less in the know. So that squares something of a circle that we've kind of been dancing about.
Yep.
And yeah, I mean, you know, I think the benefit of owning an NHL team is to have a controlling interest and, you know what I mean? Like, feel like you're the guy, the civic leader, mm-hmm. the person trying to bring a championship to the home city. You know, that's really where the value is it's as like a piece of art, right? The lived experience of it. As an investment, to have a minority of the Canucks, I think it's a much tougher entity, right? I think the valuation is difficult from the perspective of the arena is aging. There's major city infrastructure in close proximity in the Georgia Viaduct, right? There are buildings on its footprint. So that makes it difficult to implode, right? Difficult to sort of update, right? It's going to need a huge CapEx spend at Rogers Arena because that building and like reached the end of its functional, quote unquote, which is industry speak for no longer having the sorts of areas required to generate revenue the way new buildings can, right? Reached the end of its functional lifespan and is going to be very difficult to rejig appropriately, right? So you put all of that together, you know, the rights deals are done, which ups the value, so that's good. The regional rights are lucrative, so that's extremely helpful. There's a big corporate sponsorship base. You know, it's obviously a hugely engaged hockey market, so it's not like a poor investment necessarily, but it's not probably, like, if you were buying the entirety of the Canucks, I don't think, like, a $2 billion valuation is out of the question. But if you were buying a minority stake, a quarter stake of the Canucks, I think all of a sudden it's like $2 billion, we sure?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, there's a different level of skepticism because you're not deriving the same value out of it of having a controlling stake in, like, the team you love, right? And in fact, you know, I think a lot of people have been pretty skeptical of how this team's operated from the ownership suite on down. So it's like, you want me to invest in that?
Number one, if you're okay, I want to come in as a minority investor. What rights do I have to impact how the team is
run? What's our direction?
Like, I don't want to just be like, here's my money, and then I'll check in every year to see how it's appreciated. Like, I want some say here, and I want that to be contractually stipulated. That, listen, I'm not in a position to be like a minority investor in an NHL team, but if I was, that would be my prerequisite, my precondition. Well,
and if I was, I'd be really concerned about sort of the state of the building. And because, you know, how do these sports teams add value? It's by adding entertainment districts, right? It's by extra. And you know, there's an extent to which a you know, the Aquilini Investment Group, given their holdings in restaurants and wineries, right, alcohol sales and real estate and real estate development, are like uniquely well situated to benefit from some of those auxiliary revenue streams that add value to the franchise. So that's like the positive side of investing in the group. But I do think there are fundamentals about like the footprint of the building, the age of the building, and some of the infrastructure difficulties around the building that sort of also limit how easy it's going to be to add those auxiliary revenue streams. So if you're looking at it purely as a minority investor, you know, a quarter stake for $500 million, as PJ report is reporting, right? A $2 billion valuation, that becomes like, okay, well, what, I mean, how much different are we really than Ottawa?
Yeah.
How much different are we really than Ottawa? Because that was a $900 million valuation. That didn't even hit $1 billion.
Yep.
Right? Like, realistically, what are we talking about? We're talking about, yeah, maybe a 25% premium for market size and corporate base. Okay. You know, like, they own their own arena with far more flexibility and a city that's desperate and has been open for 15 years despite myriad scuttled opportunities to help us create an arena district or an entertainment district in and around this hockey team. Like, what? Why are we two times as expensive as the Ottawa Senators?
I also,
like, isn't that a fair question to ask if you're considering the investment?
100%. Especially, yeah, if it's not your toy, if it's not your thing to run and do with what you wish, right? And I also think, like, you just think of, I think the minority ownership thing in sports is often pretty fraught for these reasons, right? And I mean, look at, like the Lakers just sold, right? And if I'm correct, the Walter group, the Walter family, first became minority owners of the Lakers. There was a partnership there. Now, that did have like a contractual stipulation where it was they got the right of first refusal to buy the team if it came to that. But like, it went from a minority ownership to, actually, you know what? We're just going to buy the team outright. The Dallas Mavericks, I think Mark Cuban sold a majority stake, but it was like, oh, I'll stick around and keep running the team. And then it was like, ah, no, actually, I'm not really interested in doing that in minority capacity. And then he leaves. You know what I mean? Like, I think often those are kind of almost inevitably short-term arrangements because of the friction we're describing, right? Like, if you are forking up that much money, a huge part of the benefit of owning a sports team is to be the guy in charge, the face of it being in charge, and you don't get that as a minority owner. You could even go back to, like, John McCaw and the Griffiths family with the Canucks, right? Like, that was a minority ownership situation that ended up being a majority ownership situation.
With tough consequences for the Grizzlies, and obviously the team didn't fare all that well during the Orca Bay era either. I mean, an interesting story to continue to track. Again, I think the Canucks are a very desirable asset, professional sports franchise to own and operate in their entirety, but I think they're a different proposition, and I would be stunned by a $2 billion valuation. Like, I wouldn't be stunned if you were selling the team for $2 billion, but I would be stunned if a minority investor saw it that way without the premium part of this, without the controlling interest. I feel like it's a much harder sell, and I'd be pretty surprised if they're able to find a partner. I would be stunned if it came in as high as $500 million.
Yeah, and just to wrap this up and let everyone's imaginations run wild here, PJ in his article, Patrick Johnson, which you can go check out at Post Media, The Province, says, yet the rumors persist that there is a transaction brewing. When you start hearing names bandied about as potential investors, and those names come from three separate, totally unrelated sources, one in the NHL, one in social media, the third in a curious overlap of winemaking and real estate, you do let your eyebrows rise, especially when it's names connected to major global alcohol brands or shipping or restaurants. So there you go. Not naming any names of potential investors, but names connected to major global alcohol brands or shipping or restaurants. So if you want to let your imagination run wild, there you go. There's the latest from Patrick Johnston on the Canucks ownership situation, a potential minority investment from Post Media. We will take a break here momentarily. Dmitry Filipovich is going to join us in the final segment. But of course, it's never too early to get your Vancouver Giants season tickets. Tickets start at under $19 at VancouverGiants.com/season tickets. Dmitry wraps up the week with us next here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. 2 Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance here. We're broadcasting live from the Kintec Studio. 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at dunbarlumber.com. Now joining us Friday afternoon, as he always does, he's the host of the Hockey PDOcast on the Sportsnet Radio Network. He's our pal, Dmitry Filipovich. Dim, what's going on, buddy?
Fellas, what's going on? I need this. You know, we were off last week. Didn't get to chat with the two of you. There's no hockey games anymore.
I'm sure you missed it so much.
I've got a lot of free time to kill. I've been just kind of pacing around the studio back and forth, figuring out what to do before the draft comes. So this is a great way to
I would save it. There's only so much fantasy football research you can do, but I know that's not true for you. Well, I know that's not true for you and
Trance. Well, I was going to say, Thomas is really testing the limits of whether that's possible or not.
Trance has discovered that, in fact, there is no limit to the amount of fantasy football research you can do. All right, so we haven't chatted since the Stanley Cup final wrapped up here. Mm-hmm. Is it as simple as how much deeper does the analysis need to go than like, holy cow, Florida was an incredibly good team? You know what I mean? Like, obviously there's more interesting ways of framing. You can dive into what made them a good team and everything, but like, I almost think anything that doesn't start with the level they got to, especially as the playoffs continued, is kind of missing the forest for the trees.
Yeah, especially I feel like the Oilers goaltending situation, and obviously that's always going to be a bugaboo for them, but I feel like that was a bit of a red herring, right? It's very easy to point to that, and you know, Skinner in game 6 has that blocker save that just jumps out the rebound to Barkov and they make it 3-0. But the reality was that game 5 and 6, Florida just completely locked in. They gave the Oilers no scoring chances, 5-on-5. They really played peak Panthers hockey, just dominated them at even strength, and that was my lasting takeaway from that series, right? It was a team that has played 68 playoff games the past 3 years, made it to 3 straight Stanley Cup finals, repeated as back-to-back champs, and looked like the best version of themselves towards the end of it, as opposed to crawling towards the finish line. 100%. And so this talk of whether they're a dynasty or not and whether they need to win one more to qualify, regardless of what happens next year, they're an all-time team for me already, but they also are looking like they're in pretty good shape. We'll see what happens with Bennett and Ekblad and Marchand, certainly, but they're going to bring back the same core. I'm sure they're going to find ways to get the next Nate Schmidt and Tomasz Noshek and these guys for cheap on the margins, and they should be viewed as the favorite again heading into next year. And to say that in year 4 of this is a remarkable accomplishment for them.
But I think you're bang on about the fact that they were like accelerating. You know what I mean? They just kept playing better as the playoffs went on rather than slowing down at all. And not that they were really bad at any point in the playoffs. You know, they made short work of Tampa Bay in the first round, but they fall down 2-0 against Toronto in that series. And really from that point, and even falling down in game 3 from that point, it was just like there was a blip here or there, but it was just pretty much pure dominance from them after that.
Yeah, they executed remarkably. Yes. They got contributions throughout. You see what Anton Lundell in particular in that line throughout really did, but especially in that clinching game and the effort he had on the 2-0 goal, I believe, at both ends of the ice. It's just a remarkable hockey team. There's a reason why they're the gold standard in the NHL right now, and it was a vintage performance from them. And I just think that's incredibly impressive because I know the Oilers didn't have Hyman. They had the goalie questions. Ekholm, certainly after coming back late in the Western Conference Final, wasn't himself, and he was kind of targeted by the Panthers as that series progressed. But that was a really good Oilers team that made pretty quick work of everyone they faced in the West after a slow start against the Kings in round 1. And I imagine if they'd played anyone other than the Panthers, it probably would have looked very similar to that, where they just would have been feasting off the rush. McDavid and Draisaitl would have been going nuts. And instead, you have Barkov and Forsling just completely putting the clamps on them. And after that, they had no answers for it. So the full takeaway for me, I know people are going to be quick to, the Oilers lost in the final again. What does this mean for McDavid's legacy? All this stuff. It really just fully boils down to centering the Panthers and just what an impressive, dominant team that was.
Absolutely.
Are there lessons that teams can draw from Florida, or is it as simple as they have more top line caliber players than basically anyone we've seen in the NHL have on one team at the same time in a long, long time?
Well, thank you for teeing me up to steal your original point that you said on our game 6 post game on the PDO cast, but I completely agree with it. And so I'm going to co-opt it here. What Bill Zito and this Panthers team has done is just very tactically take a bunch of swings over the past couple of years on guys who they felt through their pro scouting were either undervalued on the teams they were on, maybe miscast, or serving as an opportunity as a grounds for a reclamation projects like a Naismith, for example, where he's clearly a limited player, probably shouldn't be playing significant minutes in a top four, but you get him playing on a third pair with Kulikov where he just has to skate forward and gets to play with the puck, and that pairing dominates and really didn't make any mistakes in that series against the Oilers. And so that's sort of the lesson for me here, despite all the conversation and rhetoric about the state taxes and all the benefits they have with the sunshine and palm trees and all that. It's just the way they approach this of just bringing in these guys. I mean, the churn, you look at the first team that lost to Vegas in year one of this run and how much they turned over the roster. The core is still there, certainly, but I think only 8 or 9 guys from that team are still on this version, and they just replaced everyone else on the margins, got maximal value compared to what they were paying them, and they're probably going to do it again this summer. And so I feel like that, from a roster building perspective, you certainly need Forsling and Barkov and Lundell and Tkachuk and those guys in place to enable all of it to happen. But I do think the other stuff that they did along the way is something that a smart team is going to look at and be like, all right, well, maybe we should try to do this ourselves.
If we sort of go back, like, let's step back and sort of look at the profiles of the bets, right? Because there's the buyout bucket, right? There's the waiver claim bucket, but that's included guys like Yolevi, Juulsen, Forsling. I know they all have Canucks ties, so it's especially relevant to our listeners, but I feel like the actual sort of commonality there, the cheap defenders that they've swung on, whether they've worked or not, is like pedigree. Now, Forsling didn't have the draft capital, right? So I'd say pedigree as opposed to draft capital. Forsling didn't have the draft capital, but he spiked significantly against his age group, right, at the U-20s, like very early on in his career, and then didn't figure it out, and they were sort of willing to bet on that. And then you've got the draft capital trades, which are more expensive. The Reinhardt-Bennett deals obviously stand out among them, although there's more that we could point to. Seth Jones might be in that bucket as well, where you sort of just kind of keep gambling on guys who had extraordinary draft pedigree, even if they haven't necessarily delivered on it to this point in their career. And then the last one is the traits defender, right? Gudas and Nico Mikola would be examples of this. And maybe you could say some of the buyout guys like Schmitz, puck moving, and OELs, you know, would fit into this as well, where it's like, okay, this guy hasn't necessarily done great, but if we get a guy with traits, given how we play, and they'll never have to skate backwards, we can make it work.
Yeah, I'd add Brandon Montour on that as well. Obviously,
yes,
he was on this year's
yes,
team,
perfect.
But a guy who first in Anaheim and then he goes to Buffalo. The underlying numbers look poor, but clearly an elite skater, so powerful, and they just bring him in and just say, all right, just do what you do best all the time, and we'll worry about everything else. Having the forwards they do allows him to do so, but I'm right there with you. I think that's a very valuable lesson, and I think the other one is, and maybe this is easier said than done, or easier after you've had this success, but you could argue they were already doing it even before they made their first Stanley Cup final, and it's just the organizational investment from the ownership group in terms of how much they're spending. I know a topic that Drance is very familiar with is the new practice facility and how much they sunk into that. But you go on down the line in terms of look at all these contract structures, and that's going to be something to really consider as a differentiator with the cap going up and teams trying to convince players for why they should take their money. All of their guys that they've signed over these past couple of years, it's just completely maxing out all the structure and signing bonuses. Every year, it's a $1 million base salary, everything up front in signing bonuses. And so beyond the state tax and beyond the sunshine, if I'm a star player, that's a very nice contract for me to sign. It's like, oh, I'm just going to get all of this money up front and not worry about it. Yeah, of course I'll sign it. It's going to definitely beat the alternative.
And Dimitri, what else does it do?
Buyout proof.
And it creates a situation where those players, from a trade value perspective going forward, right, cost less than their cap hit.
Yep.
So even if your bet doesn't work out, you've paid the player so much that now going to like a rebuilding team that just needs talent, it's like, hey, you just need a guy to like be a good pro. We've got a guy who's a good pro. He's won with us. And although he's going to take up $8 million against your cap, it's only actually an average of $5 million in real cash, and that's a very appealing prospect. So not only does it make it easier to land the guys, but it enhances their value over the life of the contract. It's devious.
Yeah, I mean, they're not going to do it now because he's meant so much to the organization. He played so well. He won them back-to-back cups. But if they were in a position where, let's say they had lost this year and they were like, all right, we need to actually add an impact forward. We got to shed $10 million in cap space. All of a sudden, you look at Bobrovsky's contract expiring and it's a $10 million AAV, but it's $5 million in actual salary. The no trade clauses come down to the point where you actually could facilitate a trade, and that would become an option for them. So they're not going to need it, but the way they structured it at least allowed them a scenario where if push came to shove, they could do it. Whereas a lot of these other contracts, teams kind of box themselves in and you're stuck sort of handcuffed and then having to trade other players you might otherwise not want to for peanuts.
So let's look at Edmonton for a second here, because I think you're absolutely right that maybe people are making a little too much about the flaws of the team having lost consecutive series to the Florida Panthers. Now, having said that, I also think there's major challenges for them ahead, right? And yep. You look at the age of the roster and all that, the goaltending situation. What would your kind of big picture strategy approach be to, I don't want to say like retooling or anything like that, but making sure this is going to be a long-standing, durable window for the Oilers? Like, what steps are necessary to make sure they can stay at this level for the next 3, 4, 5 seasons?
I think the first one would have to be not giving Trent Frederick an 8-year deal. Where
really, that's not number one on your list? Sign Trent Frederick, 8 years.
Yeah, between 3.5 and 4. So you're not even making a concession on term or AAV. He's
you're
really
getting nothing.
The best of both. Wasn't listen, like he, when they acquired him, he was hurt, right? He only plays 7 minutes in the regular season for them before jumping into the playoffs. I think he's a better player than he showed this postseason, but he was quite bad for them.
I hope so.
Yeah. I
don't know if he had a productive touch. I don't know if he had a productive touch in 8 weeks of hockey.
2 years ago, he showed definitely more for the Bruins, certainly. And I think he's capable of more. I'm with you, though. Like, a lot of them were silent killers, too, right? It was like puck rimmed around the wall. If in capable hands, someone stops it and gets it to a teammate, all of a sudden you're cooking. And instead, he'd like fumble it, maybe turn it over, but at least engage in a puck battle, and it would immediately just kill whatever advantage they previously had.
It didn't
had.
Look like a loud turnover, no. But it didn't gain you anything either. Yeah.
And players like that are, it's always so difficult because he's very active and involved. And so he's kind of like around the puck. And so if you're not really paying close attention or looking at it with a critical eye, you're thinking, oh, well, you know, he's all over it. He's working so hard.
We gotta sign this guy for 8 years.
I know. And so, yeah, that would be certainly one for me. I mean, listen, they're going to, I imagine, explore dumping Evander Kane's contract, and a law was made of him coming back, and last year he wasn't healthy and got hurt halfway through that Stanley Cup final. He didn't contribute anything for them in this series, only 1 year left. And so if they can move off that, all of a sudden that would create five or so for them, a potential Victor Arvidsson either buyout or dump in the last year of his deal. I've seen a lot of conversation about what like could they get off of Darnell Nurse's contract? What would that look like? I mean, first off, I don't think there'd be a market. Secondly, he has a full no move clause and a ton of term and money attached to it, with signing bonuses backloaded as well, comparing to what Florida did. And so I don't see that as a feasible possibility for them. It's going to be a pretty simple offseason for the most part, in terms of you sign Evan Bouchard, and I'm sure there's going to be some sticker shock with people claiming that he's not worth it, but that's a deal you have to do. You hopefully convince Connor McDavid to sign his extension this summer, so that this isn't something dragging into next year and another thing you have to worry about. And then hopefully doing what they had done previously, as opposed to what they did last offseason, which is bringing in more speed, guys that can play in the top six. I mean, you look at what they were able to get, and it was a great addition for them in Vasily Prokhorov, and what he added considering his salary and the acquisition cost. More of those types of players who can at least battle and be difference makers in terms of retrievals and creating opportunities for their skilled players. And so a couple more of those guys, theoretically, it should be a pretty easy task, but unfortunately they really fumbled that this past offseason for the most part. And so they got to get back to that, I think, first and foremost.
Yeah, it's going to be fascinating to see how they navigate things from here on out, especially with the Connor McDavid extension or not signing an extension hanging over it for the summer. So looking ahead to July 1st here, and we've already seen a fair amount of activity, I'd say, since the Stanley Cup wrapped up. You know, Matt Duchene signing, Mason Marchment getting traded to Seattle, Ryan Donato signing. Is there a team that you would say, like, you're fascinated to see what they do? Like, what team are you most curious to see what their strategy is, what they do, what they're able to accomplish when free agency opens on July 1st? And I'll throw like trades at the draft and stuff into that.
You'll
as well.
Never believe this, but the Utah Hockey Club, the Utah Mammoth, have my attention. And it hasn't deviated since the regular season.
Now, what about your curiosity?
I've been fixated on them, even though they haven't been playing games. They're in a fascinating spot, though, because they have a bunch of cap space. They were very close last year. They have a clear need for adding guys in this sort of age window to play with Keller and Cooley and Gunther. And they won the lottery to get the fourth overall pick. And that's a high, very desirable asset in this year's class. And so we'll see if they wind up ultimately making that pick or whether they use it to add a young winger that can play with those guys. But they're going to be very aggressive, I imagine. They have offer sheet opportunities, as I think we've spoken about in the past as well. And so they're a team where it's like a, it's a neat nexus for me between legitimate possibility of them, like the feasibility of them actually doing some of these moves, and the desire to do so and it making sense for them. So I feel like them and then the Hurricanes, similarly, with all the cap space and assets they have and the desire to get over the Eastern Conference final hump, those are the two teams that probably have the most punching power, in my opinion, of actually swinging one of these big deals, whether it's on the free agent market or on the trade market come the draft next weekend.
We talked about sort of big picture lessons for the from the Panthers build, and I think Pod Colson, like sneakily, Pod Colson is a Panthers type bet
for sure,
right?
Yep.
And so I'm curious, like for a team that's further away, and you know, not entering like an imperial era like the Florida Panthers are, where everyone wants to play there, and you know, post on Instagram with Brad Marchand after winning a Stanley Cup. What lessons can teams that are mid-range? Let's do it in buckets. What can a team like the Canucks draw from it? What can a team like the Chicago Blackhawks draw from it?
From the Panthers' success?
Yeah.
I think certainly just adding more good players would be a good start. Certainly. I feel like when I look at those rosters and their deficiencies, that would probably be a starting point.
I think my take is we're focusing too much on the finishing touches rather than the foundation.
Right.
You know, like that, and especially if you're the further you go down the standings, the more that's true. Like what Chicago needs to do is find like Alex Barkov.
Yeah.
And I don't just mean what he does on the ice, but what he does off the ice as well. Like that's step one. Chicago might be Connor Bedard. He might be able to be that. We don't know if he's that kind of culture carrier and leader and everything, but like none of what we're talking about with Florida matters if you don't have Barkov in place. So like step one, find your Sasha Barkov. That, and everything else has to be built around that.
Yeah, I'm not sure if you guys have spoken about this, but Drance and I via text have, I've been so fixated and blown away by how everything they do is done correctly, right? As soon as they win the cup, Sasha Barkov hands off the cup to Nate Schmidt and then Seth Jones and all the guys who haven't won it previously. You see that clip that came out on the final shift of Paul Maurice getting the fourth line out there and giving them this passionate speech about how they wouldn't have beaten Toronto when they were down 2-0 in game 3 at home if they hadn't stepped up for them. And so little things like that, I think it's probably easier to accomplish that when you just have a really good team that's already won a Stanley Cup as opposed to one that's been struggling and trying to get out of that rut. But it's remarkable how they do all the big things right, but also all the little things on the margins on and off the ice. And so that would be something I'd certainly be trying to reflect. But I'm with you, Jamie. I think it's a great point and something we lose track of. It's like everyone's trying to be cost efficient and
I can't believe they made that. They did so well in the Brad Marchand trades. Like, that's true.
Yeah.
But like 25 other teams, if they traded a second round pick that turns into a first for Brad Marchand, it's not like that would have catapulted them to the Stanley Cup. It's
nor
like
would he have looked as good on them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, and he wouldn't have played like that. Like, that was the finishing touch, but it only mattered because of all the work they'd put in before that.
Yeah, I'm with you. And there's such a depth of that high end talent. I mean, Anton Lundell and Eetu Luostarinen would be great second liners on pretty much every other team in the league, and they get
first liners.
Yeah, well,
Eetu Luostarinen's a first line player.
If you want to be frustrated by a 6% shooting percentage where he's missing great opportunities, sure, but the Panthers can live with that.
I do want that. I want a really good player. I mean, are we sure that he is not better than Matthew Nyes? Matthew Nyes.
Wow. You're sure he is better than Matthew Nyes?
But the thing is,
I think so. Yeah.
The good thing is
he's better defensively.
The good thing is that the things that he is better at are not the things you necessarily have to pay for, right? Like the breakaway goals that Matthew Nyes scores in the first two rounds of the playoffs are the flashy things that are going to attract people's attention and command a premium, even on an RFA deal. Whereas Eetu Luostarinen, you're going to be able to get that guy for $3-4 million or whatever he winds up signing for, because no one's going to be that blown away necessarily, but you watch it every night and you watch it over the course of a long playoff run and you just grow such an added appreciation for it.
I do think that's another like sneaky takeaway from Florida is like the idea of the, like, remember people used to call Shane Batty in the NBA like the no stats all-star, and it's like Gustav Forsling, like elite defensive defenseman. It's like, yeah, he's making whatever, he's making money, it's not like he has on a league minimum or anything, but it's like he's never going to be paid in a way that reflects his actual value, you know what I mean? And even like all of their players, like Barkov on a really good deal, but like, you know, he's not going to win the Art Ross, so he doesn't make as much as those guys, but he's an elite defensive player. And you go down the list, they have so many guys like that where they bring value that doesn't get captured in their salary.
For sure. And they're, man, are they ever enjoying this Stanley? I've been just following it's all the content. Fantastic. I mean, the Brad Marchand stuff, certainly thanking every team, and the Canucks got a nice little shout out there as well for Gus Forsling and drafting him.
Although they got snubbed on Gadjevich.
They really did. And Gadjevich was such a breakout star in that Stanley Cup final. I mean, the memes from Green 3.
He was so good.
Yeah.
I think he looked like a wildling.
I think my favorite moment of the celebration has been the Barkov ring camera video of him taking it to his neighbor. And like the repartee between him and the neighbor, the relationship they seem to have, really cracked me up. I really enjoyed that one.
I told Rance, I'm like, man, imagine just getting woken up at 5 a.m. by a drunk Sacha Barkov. And he's like, that would be lovely. He's such a nice guy.
That'd be amazing. Yeah.
He's
awesome.
Such a nice guy. Yeah. Just be like, I thought you'd want to see the cup. Yeah, and just, you'd be like, you're right, I do. Thank you. That's just very considerate.
Offer him a cold long drink and you guys are set.
Yeah, that actually sounds like a lovely time.
Yeah, 5 a.m., here you go. Let's just bring in the Stanley Cup. Let's see what's going on. But yeah, I agree. Like, and again, Drans, you've made this point. They're never not recruiting. And obviously, every team celebrates winning the cup and all of that, but it's like, if you're a veteran who's got to pick somewhere to go play, and you're like, oh, I've never won a cup, maybe I'm willing to sacrifice a little bit here. Like, this probably looks pretty good. What's going on in Florida right now?
Also, what's an H Mick going to get on the open market this summer? At least a 4x4 from someone, right?
At least 4x4. You think? Unless he just is like, he's made a lot of money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, unless he's just like, let's roll around it back, you know? And don't ignore, like, these guys are going to spend, by the time these guys sober up,
so you're talking about December?
Yeah, I was going like mid-August here. Yeah,
they're going to be on a yacht marlin fishing in 72 hours, being like, yeah, you know, I have this offer here, this offer there, this offer here. Or, you know, I've been thinking, like, should we all just take a little less and, like, keep marlin fishing?
I really hope none of these guys are operating sharp objects within the next 72 hours based on some of the videos I've seen of Ryan.
Well, no, you just sit on a boat. Yeah, you just sit on the boat and like maybe once you jump off the crow's nest.
I was going to say, I don't think they're going to be catching a lot of marlin.
No, I don't think that would go well. We don't even have to wait 72 hours. They're already like Sam Bennett's like, I'm not leaving. Brad Marchand, give me a contract bill. Like, they're already like, yeah, screw it. Let's just run it back.
Except Aaron Ekblad's giving, like, breaking the fourth wall and giving, like, a Shakespearean soliloquy on his time in Florida. So maybe the whole group doesn't quite stay together. We'll see.
Yeah, that was a very sad speech. Immediately followed by Brad Marchand being like, man, you're bumming us out. We're here to party.
You're killing the vibe, Aaron. What are you doing, buddy? Tim, great stuff as always, man. We appreciate it. We'll do, we got at least one more hit here, right? Yep. On the day of the draft next week. So that'll be exciting. Have a great weekend, Tim. We appreciate it. Everyone who's listening, have a great weekend as well. Hey, Abby Canucks with a chance to get the job done tomorrow in the at the Abbotsford Center. So that should be very exciting, and we'll be back on Monday to talk one way or another about what's going on in that series. Can't find the latest episodes of your favorite HGTV, Discovery, and Food Network shows? Rogers Xfinity TV has the newest seasons of the top-rated shows on these popular channels, while other providers are no longer including them in their TV lineup. If your TV provider doesn't carry these channels, you're missing out on new seasons of Celebrity IOU, Hometown, Beat Bobby Flay, Expedition X, and more. Don't be fooled by other channels pretending to be these networks you know and love. Get the latest with Rogers Xfinity TV at rogers.com. Have a great weekend. Thanks for listening here on Sportsnet 650.